You're listening to JD and Tammy Rucker as we deliver the NOQ report, or as we like to call it, the NOQ report. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and enjoy.
Those of you who watch the show regularly know that my opening monologues are generally pretty long. I can barely squeeze them in, and sometimes a monologue alone can go the full hour length of the show, but today I'm going to cut it short because we have two guests. One who I talked to yesterday following the Atlanta shooting. I wanted to get somebody who was in the gun advocacy, Second Amendment protection area of politics. So I looked to our good friends at Gun Owners of America. They presented me with Mike Hammond, general counsel, who knows a thing or two or 10 or 500 about fighting gun control. And so we were blessed to have him join us for a phone conversation. Couldn't get him on video. My bad. Wasn't his fault. But then here in just a few minutes, we're going to have former Trump campaign deputy campaign manager from 2016, Rick Gates, who has been gallivanting back and forth in and from Washington, D.C. You've seen him on Newsmax and lots of other places. He's really getting around. And I wanted to get his perspective on the filibuster, because my contention is that the two things are very closely tied together. A lot of times people will look at the filibuster and say, oh, you know, they're trying to use that as a threat to go after, for example, the easiest way to put it is the voter fraud bill they have out there that's designed to make the policies various states enacted throughout the 2020 election, the lockdown era. They're trying to make that permanent and universal. And that's don't even get me started. I'm not going to be talking about that. I think that that's wrong, though. I don't think that they're threatening for that. They would like to, but it's a big time loser. Okay, if they kill the filibuster and use that to push their voter fraud act, then even I don't know if they'll be able to commit enough voter fraud in 2022 to be able to retain control of the House or the Senate. I think they'll be obliterated in 2024. And I think they know that, you know, those are two, it's incompatible. It's kind of like, it's so blatantly cheating. It's like, we're going to remove the filibuster so we can pass a bill that allows us to maintain permanent control of Capitol Hill and the White House. No, that's not going to fly. But on the other hand, they could use the filibuster in regards to gun control and vice versa. In other words, they play one against the other. We need to pass gun control, lots of it. And if you guys are going to oppose, then we're going to figure out a way to get around you by eliminating the filibuster. And then, so in other words, they're going to threaten the filibuster rule change to pass gun control. And if they cannot, then they will use it in the other direction. In other words, they will force the change of the filibuster rule in order to pass gun control. Either way, I don't want to say they win, you know, it's a win-win situation. It's a better optics situation for them, because they'll have what they believe to be a good narrative, a good storyline. Okay. Voter fraud stuff, that's not a good storyline in order to challenge the filibuster rules. Now, my contention is that, you know, with Manchin, with Sinema, with some of the others that are questionable regarding eliminating the filibuster, they're not going to be able to fully eliminate it, but they could have rules changes. And that's what I think they really want to push for. Okay. I think their goal is twofold. Number one, they want to be able to pass the radical legislation that will keep their radical base appeased. But number two, they want to do so in a way that doesn't eliminate them, their majorities in 2022. It's politics. You know, it's a nasty, ugly game. I hate it. I really do hate it. I'm going to, if you're listening to this podcast, watching this show, please refer to the article that I'm going to write about this on NOQ Report, as well as freedomfirstnetwork.com, because I think they're both important. Or, well, obviously they're both important. It's going to be one article, but I'll be publishing it on both sites, because we need to understand the dynamics here of the politics behind the politics, I guess you could say. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and get to Rick Gates. You know what? I'm not going to do a break. Let's just cut straight to the interview. And that means that I've got another, got a couple more minutes. All right. You guys get me for a bit longer. So what are we going to talk about? I'm just teasing. Got plenty to talk about. Number one, if you guys do, if you would, please give us some love. I don't want to make it sound too like I'm begging, but we are trying to find the best guests. We're trying to get the most shows out there. Freedom First Network is really growing dramatically. Our traffic this month on the website alone is going to be tenfold of what it was just a couple of months ago. We are growing in leaps and bounds. We're trying to bring on more shows. It's good stuff. So, but you can support us, not necessarily financially, though that would be nice, but you can support us by following us at Locals, FFN, Freedom First Network, Foxtrot, Foxtrot, November, FFN.locals.com. You can find us on Rumble, subscribe to us there. We've got all of our shows have their own individual channel, so I know it's a lot of subscribing, but we figured that was better way to do it, keep everything partitioned, because we want to make sure that anybody who is a host, a participant on our network, that they have access to and control over their own content. We don't want to be, you know, record label tyrants or anything like that. People can come, people can go. We want to make sure that they have that freedom, because we are, after all, the Freedom First Network. All right, that was my pitch. Let's get go ahead and throw out my. Well, you know, we have enough time. I'm gonna play the promo for my wife talking about FFN, since I've already done it. Might as well reiterate it. It's called repetition. I think it's repetitive something or another. It's an advertising technique. I'm not very good at that stuff, but we'll give it a shot. And then we'll be right back with Rick Gates.
Big tech hates us. As of this recording, we've been banned by Spotify, YouTube, and Twitter. And we've had numerous warnings from Facebook. But that's okay. They will not deter us from always focusing on the truth. We will not be beholden to the gaslighters and propagandists. So, where can you find us? Head over to Rumble, Brighteon, BitChute, and other video channels, as well as networks like Gab, Parler, and Minds. But the place where we can really use your help is on Locals. We need 1,000 followers on Locals so we can publish all our content there without limits. Please go to ffn.locals.com. That's Foxtrot, Foxtrot, November.locals.com, and follow us. This will help us preserve our content and continue to tell the truth to the world. Thank you to all our listeners, and God bless.
Our next guest was Deputy Campaign Chairman for the 2016 Trump campaign. He was also on the President-elect's inaugural committee and co-founder of the America First Policies Super PAC for President Trump. He's currently a Newsmax panelist, a columnist, and a ghostwriter. He's the author of Wicked Game, an insider's story on how Trump won, Mueller failed, and America lost. We are blessed, pleased, and honored to have Rick Gates joining us today. Rick, my friend, how are you doing, sir?
Doing well, JD. Thanks very much for having me.
It looks, based upon the background, it looks like you're coming to us live from Washington, D.C. Is that fair?
I am indeed in Washington, D.C. It's a little empty right now, but we're still here.
It is empty, and it is a ghost town, just as it is out here in California. Other places like Texas seem to be thriving, Florida, but in the very, very progressive areas that you and I reside, not so much. So we are now on day, just anything over 50 days, or 54, 56, something like that, of the Joe Biden administration. You were there, live on the ground, during the first 50 some days of the Trump administration. Tell me, what's the difference? You know, you're in DC. What's the difference as far as excitement, as far as just the overall sentiment coming from the White House, and then coming from America towards the White House?
Yeah, it's a great question. If you look at the contrast between Donald Trump as president and Joe Biden just in their first 50 days. And we've come across, you know, we've come to the point now where Joe Biden's turned the corner. He's a little over 50 days. And if you contrast the comparison of what each of them have been able to do, the mood of the city, everything, it's so different. It is just, it's night and day from when Trump was president and kind of the excitement of an outsider coming in and just literally going through and turning around policies and other initiatives as fast as he could, because he had made promises to the American people. And with Joe Biden, we kind of just see this very lazy approach, very quiet, no enthusiasm, no motivation. You sense it all around the city in particular, and I think it expands outside the city, of just, you know, what exactly is Joe Biden doing? Is he capable of, you know, being president? What can we expect to see? And certainly, you know, as we, you know, potentially talk about some policy initiatives, there's just such a difference in approach and how each president has thought about what they want to do and keeping those promises to the American people. And just, you know, from an optics perspective, I mean, if you come to DC, literally the entire Capitol area, including the office buildings and everything, there's fencing and barbed wire still around it. There are National Guard trucks. There are police officers. I mean, it makes it look like, you know, Alcatraz. And so it's just a very unfortunate sight for people to kind of be staring at in the midst of the greatest country in the world that's supposed to be a free democracy, by the way. It doesn't really send those signals out right now.
No, I don't think it does either. And it isn't just, of course, what we're seeing as far as sentiment or, you know, the razor wire around the Capitol. And it's not just what's happening in D.C. We're feeling the sentiment across the board. But to be fair, I mean, when we compare 2017 to now, Trump didn't come in with a pandemic in, you know, or with the, absolutely, I guess, the lockdowns of the pandemic. So do you think that, obviously, that has something to do with the difference, but you've also been there when Trump was president during the pandemic. What is the difference just in, you know, say Trump's last 50 days versus Biden's first 50 days?
Sure. I think when you look at both situations, what we saw under Trump during the COVID crisis was a government responding to a virus that they had never experienced before. So a lot of it was trying to solve the issues as we went along. Obviously, with President Biden, he's had the benefit of hindsight and being able to see, you know, what Trump did right, what Trump did wrong. But if you look at what the Trump administration did, and personally, you know, for the president, I think it showed a lot of weaknesses within our government, in the sense that we had a lot of scientists that were spreading misleading information. I don't necessarily think all of it was deliberate. Certainly some of it was. Some of it seemed politically motivated at the time, in the sense of, you know, we need masks, we don't need masks. Well, we don't need masks because we're actually trying to save them for first responders. And I think there was this whole effort by the scientists who didn't really know the science behind it. And obviously, even now with Biden, I think one of the great opportunities is comparing Dr. Fauci under Trump and under Biden, and just looking at kind of the disinformation that he individually has kind of propagated, you know, over these almost a year period of time, where he's been back and forth, you know, more than a ping pong ball in a championship match. And it's very unfortunate. And what I thought President Trump was able to do well is kind of, you know, look at moving past some of the day-to-day stuff and said, you know what, you solved this by creating a vaccine. So let's focus on the vaccine. Everything else was tragic. The lives lost, the way, you know, that parts of it unfolded, whether it was under President Trump or President Biden. You know, I think a lot of people were talking about President Biden's recent address, where he had constituted, you know, a little over 500,000 people, 527,000 people died. What he didn't tell you is that just within the first 50 days of his administration, over 100,000 of those people died under his watch. So what I think it helps to show every American is, if we're going to be objective and honest about this, neither of these presidents wanted anybody to die. So to kind of politicize the travesty of COVID and what happened, you know, this was supposed to be an opportunity where we could come together. Instead, at the time, the Democrats saw it as an opportunity to politicize it, to help them win in the November 2020 elections. And I think that was just completely disingenuous, and they shouldn't have done that. And now you're seeing the flip side of it, and Biden's not faring much better. And that's going to have a significant impact as we get to 2022. And I think the tables are going to flip, and Biden's going to be in trouble.
I think that you're absolutely right. Well, he needs to be. And I think there's only a few things that could stop that from happening, you know, from 2022 flipping. What are our prospects there? And when I say our, you know, I identify as a conservative. I'm registered as an independent, not as a Republican, but I don't vote for Democrats. And I support, you know, I support the majority of Republicans out there. With that said, when it comes to the numbers, I'm a staunch supporter of making sure that we have Republicans in control of the House and Senate, and 2022 is the time for that to happen. My question for you, sir, is if you know the way that things are going now, the trajectory of this administration and this current Congress and Senate, what are the prospects of us taking back one or both in 2022?
Extremely good. And I tell people all the time, be encouraged, have hope, be motivated, because this is a great position for conservatives and Republicans to be in. We can go on the attack. We can be very aggressive in terms of identifying all of those holes and broken promises that both the Democrats and Joe Biden have been, you know, kind of, you know, propagating, you know, all this time. Look at already at a number of the policy areas that Biden has kind of put forth, and look at the impact that they're having. Look at the border crisis. I mean, it couldn't be night and day from when President Trump was president. Look at the taxes, the job losses, the Keystone Pipeline, energy independence. I mean, we can go on and on. And I'm kind of doing a apples to apples comparison, you know, in these first 50 days of the stark differences between these two individuals. And what it's going to lead to is kind of, you know, buyer's remorse. There are already people that were very reluctant to vote for Biden. And whether it was, you know, because of Trump's personality or something that he might have said, or maybe because of COVID, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. They don't realize what they've done in electing Joe Biden. You're electing status quo. You're electing a bunch of politicians that are not going to be transparent with you. And they're pushing for these policy initiatives that are hurting the American public. I mean, the most recent one was the $1.9 trillion bill that was passed. Most people don't understand almost 9%, only 9% of the total amount of that money went to actually helping COVID relief. That's it. And everything else was just kind of an irresponsible allocation of funds to different causes, whether it's states, governments, and localities were one of the biggest you know, benefactors of this. And it was interesting, Cato Institute, obviously not a conservative powerhouse, said the whole crisis that these states said they had was kind of made up. In fact, a majority of states actually made more in revenue in 2020 than they lost. And so when you think about that, and you think about how much money states received out of this bill, about $750 billion, and where is it going? We're starting to see that now in California. Teachers unions got bonuses. That's pretty amazing for not being, you know, teachers for almost a year. I'd like a job like that. You see it with other localities that are paying down their debt or putting money in their pension funds. You know, so all of these examples are very difficult to see when you look at the impact and what Biden has been doing and the wasteful spending that every one of us is going to have to make up for down the road. And I think it's, you know, very important that people keep these issues in mind, that we all do a good job of getting as many facts out as possible prior to 2022. Because I really do believe that the Republicans are in a fantastic position if they make the right strategic decisions and make sure that they get their messaging out and that the voters are energized. Because in 2022, Americans are going to be very frustrated at where we are as a country. And I think you're going to see the swing of kind of independents and moderates and even some blue collar Democrats that are going to come back to the Republican you know, side, because they will see all the problems that have occurred. And keep in mind, most people don't realize this. You know, Republicans are one vote away in the Senate and five votes away in the House. Those are not obviously great margins for the Democrats. And you're really concerned if you're a Democrat, because you got a president who, you know, won't even talk to the American people. You've got Nancy Pelosi, who's leading the House, which is just absolutely, you know, an unfortunate person. She's not really doing a good job of unifying the Democratic Party. There's obviously divisions within the party on the progressives. They're going to push a lot of the Democrats really hard on getting this $15 minimum wage, which obviously is not going to go through, as well as other, you know, very socialist progressive issues. So you're going to start seeing a lot of fracturing of the Democratic Party as well. So it is a great place to be right now. And I know it's unfortunate that President Trump couldn't win. We'd love to see him as president again. But at the same time, this opportunity to come back. And remember, all we have to do is take one of the two houses, because either one makes Joe Biden a lame duck. And that's exactly where you want to get to from a strategic point of view. Just make sure that he can't get any ridiculous policies through that he's been trying to push. And so it'll be very incumbent upon conservatives, Republicans, grassroots activists to get out there and make sure we get the vote out, because it is going to be another election cycle where people are going to be fired up. But usually, and this is pretty much the case in most elections, the you know, kind of opposition party, if you will, typically does really well. You know, we've seen it historically where in this case, the Republicans should do extremely well if they make the right strategic decisions. And so far they are. They're attacking Biden on the right things, the border crisis, COVID, all those good issues that will eventually, you know, get Republicans elected in 2022. So I'm very hopeful and very excited about 2022 and our result and our prospects.
I am too, as long as they don't, as long as they don't steal it. I don't want to talk about that. So not yet, not right now.
Real issue.
Yeah. So we're on with Rick Gates. Rick, the policies that have gone out so far have been, you know, questionable at best. Some of them have been outright you know, radical leftist. But we've always had this feeling that, you know, at least the filibuster will protect us. Now, we've thought there's Manchin, there's Sinema, there are people, the Democrats, who can protect us. But I've heard rumors that they're bending, that there is a chance that they could and will get rid of the filibuster. Have you heard any of those, or do you think that we're safe, that the Senate will keep filibuster rules at least until, well, the foreseeable future?
It's a great question. And look, there is talk absolutely about getting rid of the filibuster, and that's kind of viewed as the nuclear option. Even in past, you know, Senates, that has been raised as an issue. And it is a difficult one, because senators typically, you know, tend to be a little more grounded. You know, they're 6-year terms, not 2-year terms like the House. So there's typically more thought given into, well, what happens if we lose the majority in 2022? And so you start thinking along that lines. You know, I can see Schumer wanting to do it. I honestly, personally, don't think he has the votes to do it in the end, but it will absolutely be used as a tool to attempt to influence policy. And if the Democrats fail to get some of their key signatures through, you got to think about it from a longer term perspective. If they're thinking, how do we keep the Senate and the House in 2022? We have to do it by keeping our promises that we made, whether you agree with the policies or not. And if the Democrats can't do that, that's where they're going to start, you know, losing voters. And if that happens, they've got to figure out a way to combat that. And obviously the filibuster is one, because then you can just start jamming through policies left and right. But there is a price. And I believe that the senior Democratic leadership understands that. And they're going to be very reluctant to do it because, you know, as they say, you know, payback is not as fun, you know, down the road. And that's exactly what will happen, which is exactly kind of the reason, you know, Mitch McConnell hasn't really moved away, you know, from that model, because it could come back on the Republicans too. So it's a long held tradition in the Senate. And I think the tradition will remain overall, but it will be used as a political weapon. No doubt.
I'm glad that you mentioned that it is a tradition. We are talking about Senate rules here versus, I think that I have actually talked to people, you know, political commentators who have gotten that part wrong and said, you know, they can't overturn that law or change, you know, they should use an amendment. I'm like, wait, no, guys, this is just a rule. But anyway, I digress. So I want to, we've talked some pretty bad things about Joe Biden, but I want to find a positive here. Okay. So if you would indulge me for a second, I want you to think back over the last, you know, what is it? 2 months, first 2 months of his presidency. And I want you to pick out which press conference of his or address has been your favorite. You know, okay, I'm wording this terribly. You get where I'm getting at here. It's funny. I'm not a comedian, and I just failed miserably at it. He has supposedly his first press conference coming out next week. I am still dubious. I don't necessarily know what's going to happen. But the question is this. What is happening, and why is nobody pushing back? And why is even the media not really doing their job and saying, where are you and why are we not talking to you, sir?
Well, this goes to your question right away. And one of the good things about Joe Biden is he hasn't been on TV. He hasn't done press conferences, because we all know the reality is most of them would be unmitigated disasters. And this is the whole point of, and look, if you're a Biden advisor, you're trying to keep this guy under lock and key as much as possible. You're trying to take a preemptive stance here and make sure he doesn't make the mistakes that even his own advisors are worried about. Just look in even the scripted pieces that he's done, particularly the one last week, you know, when he was talking about the military issues at the Pentagon, and he couldn't remember his own Secretary of Defense's name. That guy that he runs the place over there. And you're going to constantly, I think, see this. And the more that he is unscripted, the more risk. So if you're certainly Joe Biden's advisors, you're going to try to keep this going as long as possible. And look, with the press conference that he's, quote, doing next week, and there's a lot of questions about it. How much of it's going to be scripted? Is it going to be taped in advance? A number of the things that a lot of people think. I mean, the fact that it's taken them almost a month from like the time they've announced it to actually taking place, what does that say? You know, I mean, the point that the White House and the current press secretary, Jen Psaki, the problems they're having is she doesn't know what her boss is thinking. At least with President Trump, everybody in the world knew what he was thinking. And a lot of times before, the staff knew what they were, you know, what he was thinking. So it is a completely different approach. And I think this is one of the things, like even in the, you know, what you would call a normal presidential administration, somebody that's been kind of ingratiated in politics, you know, usually takes a balanced approach with press conferences. President Trump has done 5, you know, within his first, few weeks of holding office in 2017. Biden hasn't had one. And I don't have a lot of high expectations for this one. And this is what the kind of the American public, or what the media has gotten the American public to do. They make the expectations so low that, you know, Biden completing a press conference is like a win for them. And so I think, you know, as we continue to see what, you know, Joe Biden does at these press conferences, and like, I don't think they're going to be very many. So, you know, a lot of people are going to be taking, you know, copious notes and trying to analyze this, because we're not going to have one to analyze for a long time. But I don't have, you know, a lot of great expectations for this. I think it's going to be very scripted out. And I think it's very different from the way that President Trump handled everything. He answered every question, whether you like the answer or not, that's totally, you know, your own opinion. But the fact that he was willing to entertain and think on his feet and speak quickly and be willing to take every question under the sun. He didn't say, oh, I'm not going to take that question. Oh, we're going to cut off, you know, the question and answers. I think, you know, most people probably saw that a few weeks ago where President Biden did a Zoom, you know, interview, and he said, what's next? And, you know, Q&A, are we doing Q&A? And all of a sudden everything just goes blank. And it was just a great example of exactly how that White House intends to operate with him. And the fact that he wouldn't stand up and say, hey guys, I want to answer questions. I want the American people to know what I am thinking, says a lot. And it really goes to this idea of transparency in our government, and it clearly does not exist. And they're going to try to protect him as much as possible.
I would say they're doing a decent job. I don't know if you saw the video that came out yesterday of him allegedly talking to the press with his hand. It appeared that his hand was going over top of a microphone. Something sure was fishy about that. But hey, we're just conspiracy theorists. I also did hear I don't know if you heard the reason that the White House had cut off that what you're referring to as far as the interview. He said, you know, okay, I think we're ready to talk about to do Q&A. And the camera person thought that he said, we're ready to talk about QAnon. And then everybody's like, oh no, cut him off. We don't want to. Okay. So that was my attempt to redeem myself after the failed joke before. So, So I do have one more question for you, but before we get to that, I want you to tell us what you've got going on as far as, do you have any books? I know you do, but spoiler, he does. But other things that you have going on as far as, you know, anything you're involved with, any organizations you'd like to tout or anything to that effect.
Sure. I published a book just before the election, and a lot of it centered on, you know, what happened, you know, behind the scenes of Trump's election. But then the second half obviously took a different approach and looked at, you know, what happened with the Mueller probe. And, you know, one of my, you know, big kind of tasks is to continue to make sure all the truth gets out. President Trump did a lot of great things right at the end of his administration by declassifying a lot of the documents that the American public hasn't been able to see. And it all related to kind of the, you know, kind of hypocrisy and even in some cases alleged corruption inside our government agencies. You know, individuals within the FBI and DOJ really going outside of their purview and their power to really attempt to take down a duly elected president, you know, and all that truth has not come out. So I want to continue to be an advocate for that and make sure, whether you know, agree with the Mueller probe or didn't agree, you know, that you know the facts. Because I think it's important historically when people look back and say, wow, how could a U.S. government go after one of its own presidents like that and create a lot of the situational things that happened that were just absolutely false, made up, you know, hypothesized, and really some of the unethical and even, you know, corrupt acts that took place. And it's good because this is what Americans need to see. They need to see that their government is imperfect. And more importantly, when you watch these entrenched bureaucrats, you know, kind of get in their little power perches, the power that they can have and the impact that it can have. And it's a really dangerous thing. So we all need to be aware of that. So that's obviously a big issue for me that, you know, I want to continue to push. And then I'm doing commentating, you know, for media organizations and writing a lot of op-eds. I really like the opportunity to write and be able to share a lot of these experiences that I've been able to have inside of politics, how elections work. I've always felt like, you know, Americans don't really get kind of the basics sometimes, and we overlook it. And people in DC get so caught up and trapped in their own world that they lose sight, you know, of what it means to be an American citizen and a voter. So I continue to do that. I'm very passionate about, you know, kind of tolerance of politics and making sure that we can have informed discussions, that we can be able to talk to somebody that doesn't share the same beliefs or policy positions as us and be able to, you know, coherently argue, you know, with one another. But at the same time, remember that we're all Americans and more importantly, we're all human beings. We all, you know, have families, we have kids. And to be able to get America back to being, I think, a much more democratic country than I think the rest of the world views us right now. So a hodgepodge of things, but certainly things I'm very encouraged and excited to do.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with hodgepodge. We do need to get you to write over a knock report, though, because that will help us and you, I think, out quite a bit. I think you actually have, if I recall, an author's box there, because you've submitted a couple of articles, which we definitely published in the past.
Yes.
We're on with Rick Gates. I've got, rather than a single last question, this is called a lightning round. You can order, you know, answer the questions with, I'm going to give you scenarios. You can give me just a percentage, you know, 50-50, or you can give me some brief commentary. I'm going to just throw them out there. You tell me what you think is going to happen. All right. Perfect. Ready? Does Trump run in 2024?
Yes and no. I think that he is absolutely going to make the overtures. A day in politics is an eternity. So I think we're going to have to wait to see what happens in 2022. If we do well, he absolutely will run in 24. If he doesn't do well in 2022, then he's going to have to reassess.
Joe Biden, is he going to be in the Oval Office in, we'll call it 2022, January 1, 2022, or has Kamala Harris already replaced him?
She seems to be replacing him. Great question. I would say that better than 50% that he has some issues that will probably curtail him and sideline him in office. There's a good chance that Kamala Harris will be there by 2022.
California, Gavin Newsom, Is he still governor after these recall efforts and the vote?
Yeah, I think he's gone. Absolutely.
New York, Andrew Cuomo, does he survive these scandals, the sexual harassment, the nursing home, the just generally being a bad dude?
No, he doesn't survive. And what you're seeing now is that the Democrats realize that, and they want to protect their own power and their own positions. So even they are selling out Andrew Cuomo, making sure that he is the scapegoat for all this. So he's done, whether it's impeachment or ultimately, my speculation is that he will take it all the way to the finish line and that he will likely resign before an impeachment vote is taken, so he's not disgraced even further.
Next, Texas governor, Matthew McConaughey or Beto O'Rourke, or do we get to keep at it?
Well, my preference would be Matthew McConaughey if he runs. I love when people like Matthew McConaughey think about running, because for me, watching President Trump run in 2016, I think gave people across America the idea that you don't have to be a politician for 30 years to run for a governor or a president. And it's going to bring forth this whole new kind of crop or generation of people that say, you know what, I can make a difference. I'm going to run, and I don't have to be a politician. I can be an outsider. So I would love to see Matthew McConaughey run. I'd like to see other outsiders run. I think he is going to run. I just hope his numbers are there so that he is excited about it as well.
Definitely. Last question. Dr. Fauci, does he make it through all of this unscathed, as he has apparently been for the last year and a half, or is it finally revealed that he is a globalist pawn of Bill Gates, George Soros, and everything evil in the world?
Well, I think Dr. Fauci is human, and he makes mistakes, and he has made mistakes. And I think, you know, the longer he stays where he is, he's going to continue to make mistakes, and he's going to continue to, give out scientific information that he believes is accurate. I think his credibility has been diminished. I think at best he will be an infamous celebrity by the time this is all over. I don't think he finishes. I think on his own terms, he will not stay with Biden for the full 4 years.
Excellent. Mr. Rick Gates, it has been a pleasure and an honor having you with us today. We are definitely going to have you on again in the very near future, sir.
It'd be great, JD. It was great being with you. I appreciate it.
Good stuff. Coming up next, we have an interview that I actually pre-recorded yesterday with I don't want to spoil it. Let's just say with a man who knows a thing or two about moose attacks in New Hampshire. But first, let's hear from my lovely, brilliant, talented, and scrumptious wife and co-host, Tammy.
Can you smell it? It's your favorite freshly ground coffee, brewing in your favorite cup. If you're anything like me or my family, coffee is essential for our mornings. And even more essential is good quality coffee. Well, Freedom First Coffee is our preferred choice. Made from organically grown beans from Mexico and Peru, they're then roasted here in the USA. So head on over to freedomfirstcoffee.com and choose our Founders Blend in medium or dark roast, ground or whole bean. That's freedomfirstcoffee.com. And make sure you use promo code NOCK, that's N-O-Q, for 10% off your order. And if you really want to be a freedom lover, choose a monthly subscription so you will never be without your Morning Joe. Again, that's freedomfirstcoffee.com.
So coming up shortly, we have one of the most enjoyable interviews I've ever done. Definitely the most enjoyable I've ever done on the phone. I'm not a big fan of phone interviews. Okay. It's not because I like having those on video see my face. It has nothing to do with that. It's because there's just something not, the quality isn't as good as far as the sound quality, I mean. But thankfully, this next guest made up for any sound issues by being number one, brilliant, absolutely, like just one of the smartest guys I've ever talked to on this show. But he's also funny. I was laughing. I don't laugh that often during, as you guys, I'm not a funny guy generally speaking. So you heard in my Rick Gates interview just now that, let's say I need some comedy help. Thankfully, our next guest gave me all the comedy help I needed. So we will play for you that particular, I don't need this anymore, play for you that particular interview.
Our next guest is the Legislative Counsel for Gun Owners of America. He served as General Counsel to the U.S. Senate Steering Committee and was Legislative Counsel for several U.S. Senators. He received his B.A. from Washington University and his J.D. from the New York University Law School. He was knighted by the President of Poland for his role in bringing down the Soviet bloc. We are very pleased, blessed, and honored to have Michael E. Hammond joining us today. Mr. Hammond, welcome.
Hello. Mr. Hammond was my father. Hello, J.D. Hello, America.
Hello, Mike. So yeah, I think that your job has changed dramatically in the last few months compared to what it was when President Trump was in the White House. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it's changed dramatically vis-a-vis any time during the 50 years that I've been in Washington. There aren't very many advantages to being very, very old, but one of them is you see all this come around. But now I think to a greater extent than any time in my lifetime, perhaps any time in the history of America, the very structure of our two-party republic is on the line. And I think if the Democrats get their desire, we will end up with a one-party utopia or dystopia of the type that Californians currently enjoy, along with all the ramifications of that. So there's a lot on the line, and at this point, everything's up for grabs.
Up for grabs is not a good place we want to be, but it's good to have people like you and Gun Owners of America fighting for our rights. It was conspicuous that in the first, we'll say, 45 days or so of the Biden administration that there was not much movement when it came to guns. But now we've seen a flurry of activity. You've got a couple of minor bills that were passed in the House. You have Senator Feinstein pushing her ban on, 208 guns. You have all of these things now happening. Tell us, what are you seeing in the horizon?
I wouldn't call them minor bills. They're bills intended to look minor, but in fact, they're not. There's H.R. 8, the first bill. That's a universal gun registry. What do I mean by that? Well, basically, everyone in the country, every time they transfer a gun, would be required to fill out a form. It's Form 4473. We know that the government is photographing those forms in connection with its annual inspection and making those forms computer-friendly in the sense that the first page says who you are, where you live, and what guns you have. So all they have to do is push your name in and they know where to conduct their midnight raid and exactly what guns they expect to seize. And the bill has supposedly some loopholes, but the loopholes are so hyper-technical, they become a trap. It'd be better not to have loopholes at all rather than have the structure which has an endless number of trapdoors. What do I mean by that? Well, okay, the bill says you can transfer your gun, you can give your gun to your son without conducting a Brady check. But if you give your gun to your son in exchange for doing yard work, you're a criminal and he's a criminal. The bill says you can hand your new gun to your neighbor in your dining room so he can look at it. But if you hand it to him and go into the bathroom, you're a criminal and he's a criminal. The bill says that you can hand your gun to someone to counter a bona fide emergency constituting a danger to life or serious bodily harm. But let's say your son-in-law lives in your house, the next bedroom over. You hear a bang in the middle of the night. You hand your gun to your son-in-law. If, in fact, the bang turns out to be a homicidal killer, you're lucky. You're lucky. The bill has an exception for that. If the bang turns out to be your cat playing around on your stove, you're a criminal, he's a criminal, you both go to prison. So the exercise is making owning guns so difficult that people are terrified to own guns for a fear that they're going to step through one of these trap doors.
That is insane, and we don't even know if the cat would be in trouble in that scenario either.
Maybe if it were a jaguar, you could get off, because that would constitute a danger to yourself or a danger of serious bodily harm. But unless it were a jaguar, a lion, or something which had escaped from the zoo, then you go to jail.
One of the ways that I don't want to just say just the left, because there are some on the right who are pushing this, but one of the ways that they're able to push these types of universal background check laws is to say that, number one, that they work, which we know that at the state level they simply have not, but number two, because that's where it ends, and we know that with universal background checks, with gun registries, that eventually this is the pathway to get to their Armageddon. What do you say about
that?
Well,
if they work, then Chicago, Baltimore, New York, and San Francisco would be the safest places in the country. In fact, the states that have universal background checks are the most dangerous places in the country. On the other hand, my home state of New Hampshire, where you're more likely to be killed by a moose than by a criminal with a gun, it's by and large, you're free to do whatever you want with a firearm. So the states that have no gun restrictions or very few gun restrictions are the safest states in the country. Those which have enormous numbers of gun restrictions are the most dangerous. Now, I mean, how closely do you have to parse that to realize that gun control, in fact, doesn't work at all? But I have, as to the argument that, oh, this will be the end of it, I have a story, if you have the time for me to tell it.
We have the time.
Okay. Well, I, at one time, forgive me, around 1993, while I was between the United States Senate and my stint here at Gun Owners of America as a rank for Congress, but I was also a consultant with the National Rifle Association. And I heard that the NRA was about to endorse the Brady Law. So I called up my old friend, Neil Knox, who at the time was head of the NRA, or the power broker at the NRA. And I said, Neil, I hear you're going to endorse this gun control. And Neil said to me, well, Bob Dole says, now, you know, you don't have to be in Washington for 50 years to know that any sentence which begins with those three words isn't going anywhere good. So he said, well, Bob Dole says that we can't stop this bill, but he has a killer amendment. I said, okay, what's your killer amendment? And so he said it to me, and it's too, I couldn't even understand it. It's so esoteric. I said, well, what if they take your killer amendment out in conference? And Neil said, well, Bob Dole says that if they take the killer amendment out, we'll filibuster the conference report. Well, hold on a minute. It doesn't take anyone with 120 IQ. It doesn't even take anyone with a 75 IQ to know if you can't filibuster the stupid bill with all the options you have to offer amendments, you can't filibuster the conference report either, where you have none of those procedural options. So, and Neil went on to say, and this is sort of at length the moral of the story. Neil went on to say, well, Bob Dole says that if we pass this, we'll never have any more gun control bills. Whenever someone says we need gun control, we'll just say we don't have to do it. We'll pass the Brady Law. Well, how'd that work? In fact, every concession which the left made in passing the Brady Law became a, quote, loophole, which became the centerpiece of a new campaign to achieve more gun control. And so, you know, anyone who thinks that by feeding the beast they're going to make it cure it of its desire for meat is foolish. by giving a victory to the Brady campaign, to the Bloomberg organization, you only fuel its ability to raise money. You fuel its appetite to demand more. And as a matter of fact, Bloomberg spokesman on MSNBC, which I don't recommend you watch, but I sometimes do so you won't have to. The Bloomberg spokesman said on MSNBC, the second this is passed, this is H.R. 8, the second this is passed, we'll be back for more. And in fact, that's a story. Anyone who thinks that they will quell the appetite for gun control by passing gun control, it's just foolish.
It is foolish. And we keep making that mistake. And when I say we, I'm not talking about you or me or even most of the people in our audience. I'm talking about many of the elected representatives who have in the past embraced gun control very similarly to the way that you described in your Bob Dole story. I have a question for you that is that is two parts. You can answer them in any order. You know,
okay.
Obviously
I'll answer the second one first.
Perfect.
Just to be contrary.
Perfect. And I will. I'm going to send a moose in your direction. That's how crazy this is. So we have. You work for the Gun Owners of America.
Yes.
And you guys have been. You know, nothing against any of the other organizations out there that I'm not going to name, but you guys have been, I would say, the most proactive on the legal end when it comes to across the board, but. But particularly on the legal end, you guys have really stood up, and I actually endorsed the Gun Owners of America back in 2017 as the go-to organization. If you can only join one, join them. So I'm a big fan. With that said, we've got this, you know, we have this apocalyptic scenario right now for at least the next year and a half, where Democrats have control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. We can work on, you know, I'm going to work my end to try to change that in 2022, but we still have to fight today. So my two-part question is, number one, what are you guys doing? And, you know, what can you tell us as far as what Gun Owners of America is doing right now to defend their rights? And number two, what can we, as average American citizens, do to help you?
Wow, I wish I hadn't told you that I was going to answer the second one.
So my first question.
It would have been so much easier to do it the other way around. But what you can do is log on to our website and help us. What we're doing at this point is, Dems have a 50-50 split in the Senate, but there is still the filibuster. And at this point, there are a couple of Dems who say they're not going to vote to do away with the filibuster. Is that a position we would like to be in? No. It's like hanging from our little wedge, about a half an inch thick, hanging from a little wedge as we dangle over a 1,000-foot deep ravine. The only thing I can say about having to rely on Joe Manchin, Kirsten Gillibrand, is it's probably better than actually falling into the ravine. So for the next several months, at least, probably for the next year, it will be a fight to see if we can keep the filibuster in place. If we have the filibuster, then they need 60 votes to pass any of this junk. They probably can't pass the two House bills. They certainly can't pass a ban on semi-automatic weapons or a ban on all handguns that don't have smart gun technology. And presumably they can't pass H.R. 1, which would rewrite all of our election rules so that Republicans could never win federal elections again. So the battle right now is to try to keep the filibuster. I just proofed another alert going out to Joe Manchin saying we expect you to keep your word for a change. And we hope that your listeners will join with us in fighting to keep this procedural tool in place.
We definitely need to keep it. And if it does fall, then, you know, I had one of our listeners called in one time and told me, you know what, we should hope that they get rid of the filibuster, because if they do, then America will finally get to see what happens if the Democrats get their way. And my reply to him, as somebody who lives out here in California, I said, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, after Kristallnacht and the seizing of all firearms in Germany, I mean, the Jews realized exactly what Adolf Hitler was up to. And the Jews in the Warsaw riots looked at one another and said, well, now Hitler has all the guns and we don't have any. As a result, the city of Warsaw is to this day nothing but a sort of a pile of rubble with a sort of a new infrastructure being built on top of it. To find out that your enemy is up to something genuinely evil at a point in which you can't do anything about it is probably the lowest circle of hell.
Yes, it would be. It would be. Well, I have another two questions for you, and I'm going to ask them separately this time so we can maintain proper order. Number one.
Wow, yeah, that last time was a complete screw-up.
It's okay. At least we got to remind people that where they should do is they should go to Gun Owners of America.
Gun Owners, period, O-R-G.
Gun Owners, period, O-R-G. They should O-R-G. Go there and sign up, and that's how they can help. So that was good. At least we were able to sneak that in. But I want to go with, let's start with the best case scenario.
Okay.
And we do keep the filibuster. In that scenario, though, we can expect, because the pressure was already coming from gun control advocates, they were pressuring Joe Biden literally on day one.
Yeah.
And he will be pressured even more if they cannot pass legislation. So we can assume with a high degree of certainty that he will start issuing executive orders. Are you guys prepared for that? Is there a plan in the works? Have you looked in that direction?
Well, yes, we are aware of executive orders. The one good thing about executive orders is he who lives by the pen dies by the pen. Obama promulgated a series of executive orders, and we were successful in getting Trump to repeal most of them. Those he didn't repeal, we sued in order to challenge. So we understand, I don't want to be hyper-technical, there are three specific areas. One is pistol braces, one is Palmer 80s, one is 80% receiver. The BATF is already preparing to promulgate regulations with respect to. We will challenge all those in court with Amy Coney Barrett as the swing justice. We may actually prevail on that for a change. So, yes, we are prepared for that. We know what's coming.
Perfect. So then my follow-up question to that is, let's look at the apocalyptic situation, or scenario, I should say. Mm-hmm. What happens if they do get rid of the filibuster and we start seeing a flood of Democrat legislation passing?
Wow.
What can we do?
I mean, what can you do? I can't even conceive.
It is
already saying on the Senate calendars, you know, an end to elections, D.C., statehood, national gun registries, and right down the line. So for what it's worth, Mitch McConnell has said that he is going to make it impossible for the Senate to operate by refusing to agree to any unanimous consent request. Now, as Eugene McCarthy, who once said in his advice to freshman legislators, don't memorize the rules. He said, the House rules are impossible to understand. The Senate rules are easy, but the Senate never follows them. By and large, the Senate operates by six words around which its sun and moon revolve. And those six words are, without objection, it is so ordered. If you don't get unanimous consent, you can't turn the lights on until noon. You have to spend 2 hours on morning hour each day, and then you can't adjourn at the end of the day. So unanimous consent is a pretty important threat. And McConnell is saying, I'm not going to give any unanimous consent agreements if they blow up the Senate. So it will be just literal trench warfare for the next year if in fact they succeed in eliminating or modifying. They probably won't eliminate. They'll probably try to modify the filibuster. I can only hope that we reach the point in which the composition of the House and Senate is more favorable to us before they have done irrevocable damage to our two-party republic, but I'm not betting on that. I mean, it is really a serious situation. I said before the Georgia elections that if the two Georgia seats both went to Democrats, we would be in huge trouble, and I don't revoke a word of that. We are in huge trouble. We will be engaging in trench warfare for the next 2 years. Only by the grace of God will we be able to survive this sort of intact.
Absolutely. I have one more question for you. But before we get to that question, I want to give you the opportunity to tell our listeners what they, you know, obviously we've already mentioned gunowners.com. Or I'm sorry, is it .org or .com?
Org.
Okay, so gunowners.org for Gun Owners of America. They should go there, sign up, read about it, participate, you know, find their anybody in their family to get involved.
Before you my dog, list, your cat,
your moose, whatever you have,
your jaguar, well, jaguar down in your kitchen messing up the pans.
The son-in-law probably shot him, and it was okay because it was a jaguar.
He was a mean-looking jaguar. If he was a placid jaguar, your son is probably in prison, and the jaguar is in a rehabilitative facility at the zoo.
Well, and even if it was a mean jaguar, PETA would already be after him. So, you know, the real question, and at the end of the day, the question is going to come down to, you know, when he shot this jaguar with his father-in-law's gun, was he wearing a mask? Because if he wasn't, he's
done. Yeah, and what kind of jaguar it was.
Yeah, so just before I get to my last question, is there anything else we need to know about you, any upcoming books, anything you've got going, anything the Gun Owners of America wants to announce?
Yeah, probably. Do you want my 3-hour exegesis or my 4-hour exegesis?
Let's go in between.
That's a standard reporter question, and I give my standard reporter answer, which is that we haven't covered the waterfront, but if I've answered your questions satisfactorily, and if you're happy, then I'm happy.
Well, you're definitely not a standard guest, so I'm going to hit you with a hard question.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I've long said that you know, really since, for at least the, throughout the Biden administration, I said that Democrats are going to hold off on pushing their biggest gun reform, gun control bills and actions. They're going to wait until there's a mass shooting. This morning in Atlanta, the Atlanta area,
Atlanta.
Had a mass shooting.
Yeah. So, yeah, and incidentally, if you look at the media, basically the conservative media has by and large ignored that. The liberal media has spent all day on it. So that tells you how they view the purpose of that mass shooting, for the purpose of generating a call for gun control. And specifically the aspect, all the people shot were Asians, therefore these were hate crimes and so on and so forth. I think that probably, if you look very carefully at the circumstances, is not a valid assessment, but by saying that minorities were victimized, it makes it easier for them to turn this into a call for fewer and fewer freedoms and more restrictions.
And that's exactly what they're going to do. Do you guys have a playbook for that? In other words, do you guys have, you know, when there's a mass shooting, you guys like, okay, guys, you know, meet in the war room and let's go to work.
Well, yeah, I mean, after 50 years, you do have a playbook for these sorts of things. I drafted an amendment 2 days ago, not even knowing this was going to happen. It was a, quote, killer amendment, close quote, in the event that this effort to do away with the filibuster looked like it was going to be successful. And it said, if, in fact, you are a minority and you are a victim of gun violence because of gun restrictions, which disproportionately impact on you, you can go in and sue. You can have the provision of gun control declared unlawful. You can get treble damages. You can get attorney's fees. You can have money pouring on your head if you're a minority who goes into court and claims that you were victimized by gun control.
Well, I'm a minority. I happen to be Asian American. And I am very, yeah. I am looking to pour money all over my head.
Mike Hammond. Okay. I'm 1/16 PSIOC, so
hey.
I'm 1/16 engine, so.
Let's get the money bucket pouring on you as well.
You and I do a class action.
There we go.
Get rid of this gun control.
There we go, exactly. My friend, Mike Hammond, I do appreciate you so much. And thank you for being on with us today. We will be right back, folks.
I told you guys he would be hilarious. But it's not just hilarity. It's informative. We are fighting for our rights, and we must continue to do so because the Democrats are coming at us from every angle. But it isn't just them. It's also cancel culture. It's the radical left. We have to fight so many different battles. But on top of all of these, we always have to remember that our biggest battle, the overarching battle that is the root for all of our battles, is our battle for the gospel, our battle to spread the gospel, to be faithful Christians, to do the will of God. Those are things that we cannot lose sight of. I sometimes feel like I do, and I always have to remind myself, look, politics, culture, those are fine, they're important, but they are only as important as they affect us from a spiritual, faithful perspective. So, you just keep that in mind. Lord willing, we will be back here very soon with another episode. But in the meantime, you guys stay strong, stay safe, and God bless.